Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Again, I need to remind you that we are Zooming on Monday afternoon, and the way things are going, I'm sure something will happen Monday night. Before we introduce our first guest who joined us at the last minute, but I am so, so terribly grateful, we begin, of course, with a bit of political verse. Our deadline poet, Kip Tenzer, has done some fabulous work. All right, Dave, hit it with the music.
Istanbul was Constantinople, now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople. Been a long time gone, Constantinople, now it's Turkish delight on a moonlit night.
This nation swept into a dangerous vortex, created by his flawed cerebral cortex. Congress was breached, and he soon will be impeached for sending his goons to the Capitol's doorstep.
People just liked it better that way.
So take me back to Constantinople. No, you can't go back to Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople, why did Constantinople get the worst?
Joining me right now is Mel Goodman. Now, I need to sort of set the stage for this conversation because I actually had someone else who just literally 15 minutes ago said, oh, Arnie, I'm on deadline. I can't come. And I'm like, oh, vague. I knew Mel would say yes. And the reason I knew Mel would say yes was that about 7:30 this morning, I turn on CNN and I hear that Joe Biden has announced his nomination for the CIA. And it was a fellow by the name of William Burns. And I'm like, oh my God. And the reason I was elated and I haven't smiled for a while was because Mel Goodman had written this fabulous piece at Counterpunch back in December of 2020, basically a letter to Joe Biden suggesting William Burns. And we had just talked about William Burns last week. And I'm thinking, will he do this? And then sure enough, so joining me at the last minute, but the best guest who could possibly arrive today, Mel Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University, a former CIA analyst. He is the author of just so many books. But the best thing is that he wrote an open letter to Joe Biden about selecting a CIA director. I have Facebooked it, Mel Goodman. I have tweeted it out, Mel Goodman. But I want to just start with
the last... You gave Mel Goodman a wake-up call.
Exactly. I woke you up this morning. But I want to just start with the last couple of sentences from your piece from December of 2020. And this is what you write at the very end of your open letter to Joe Biden. It's beautiful, and I posted it on Facebook. William Burns would be an excellent choice to direct the CIA. He is one of the most skilled American diplomats of the past century, cut from the same cloth as George Kennan and Chip Boland. Burns was only the second serving career diplomat to become Deputy Secretary of State. The Carnegie Endowment is the oldest international affairs think tank in the United States. Burns manages a global network of 140 scholars across six countries. He has received awards from the Department of Defense, the CIA, and the intelligence community. The appointment of Burns would send an important signal about the revival of public service, which has been demeaned for the past 4 years, and for the importance of the entire intelligence community, not simply the CIA. Much of the CIA's difficulty over the past 40 years can be attributed to mediocre leadership. The CIA would be the major beneficiary of such an exemplary appointment to an institution that has become too insular and parochial. Those are the fabulous words.
Wow. Did I say that?
Oh, you did. And I'm so happy. I posted on Facebook and people were reading it and going, Biden did this. That's fabulous. And I said, yes, it is. So, Mel Goodman, welcome to the program. But I do have to ask one quick question. So how come he's not part of the cabinet? Are you surprised by that decision?
He shouldn't be part of the cabinet. No.
He's not.
No CIA director was part of the cabinet until Reagan made William Casey part of the cabinet. And the reason why he shouldn't be in the cabinet is the cabinet is policy. The intelligence chief should not be involved in policy.
He should not be
a policy advocate. So that's very important. And it's good to hear that he won't be in the cabinet.
Well, then I'm going to make a recommendation that you write that, that you explain why what Trump did, what Reagan did, that that was a mistake. This is what he needs to do, and he shouldn't be a player in it.
He understands government. He understands governance. He understands public service. I think we're lucky to have Biden in the position he's in right now because the government's going to have to be rebuilt.
Yeah,
it's been destroyed by Steve Bannon's deconstruction of the administrative class, and you have an idiot like Trump having 4 years to do tremendous damage. It's going to be very difficult to rehabilitate certain institutions, including the CIA. That's, again, that makes the Burns appointment extremely important. And I hope the Senate understands this when they enter confirmation. Whenever anyone has gone off the tracks, you know, the very conventional tracks of putting in a general or putting in an operative or putting in someone like Bob Gates, the Senate has often said, oh, this guy's too liberal. Remember when Carter nominated Ted Sorensen? That didn't go down well, and Sorensen had to pull out. Now, of course, Sorensen was a conscientious objector, and I don't know if a conscientious objector should be head of the CIA. And then Clinton wanted to get rid of Tony Lake, who did not a very good job of running the National Security Council, which only has about 400 people. So he nominated him to be head of the CIA, which has about 14,000 people. And again, the Senate looked at him and said, oh, he's too liberal. Burns is not a conventional appointment. There's never been anyone from the Department of State even considered for this position. But remember, he's been an ambassador in places like Russia and in the Middle East. And in these embassies, and the CIA hates it when I say this, but I'm going to go off the rails and say it anyway. The CIA station overseas is located inside embassies. That means the ambassador was working with the station chief, and the station chief had to report to the ambassador because the ambassador had seniority. He was there as the president's representative. Remember, he's not the ambassador from the State Department. He's the ambassador from the White House. He's named by the president. He represents the president in these countries. Burns knows everything there is to know about the CIA. He knows all the secrets and the things that shouldn't be secret. He knows that covert action has been a strategic disaster. He knows what strategic intelligence is. And so we'll get rid of someone like Gina Haspel. Her only claim to fame was being behind torture and abuse and destroying the torture and abuse tapes. She had no right to even be nominated. In fact, she was a war criminal. She's lucky she's not in jail. Instead, she got a sentence that put her at the CIA. But Bill Burns, I think, will be, as a former intelligence analyst, I'm sure the analysts are over the moon over this appointment. And even the clandestine operatives know what has happened to the image and the reputation and the credibility and the judgment of the CIA. It has to be restored. Bill Burns can do all that.
Well, again, 7:30 this morning, I heard the news, and the first call I made was to Mel Goodman.
Happy news like that, just give a ring.
Oh, my God. Some of the reaction from when I was watching the news this morning was, oh, he's outside the CIA. Oh, he's outside. And I think this is an opportunity for someone with so much incredible credibility outside, with so much knowledge outside, that in a way, it is this sort of clean slate for the CIA, which is so helpful if they want to rebuild the institution.
Look, I'll name quickly six insiders, so-called insiders. Alan Dulles was an insider because of OSS. He was a disaster. He had to resign over the Bay of Pigs.
Okay.
Richard Helms was an insider because he was also OSS and ran operations. And he lied to the Congress and had to pay a $2,000 fine because he was guilty of perjury. William Colby was an insider. Bob Gates was an insider, and he politicized intelligence for 10 years for Bill Casey. Gina Haspel, we've mentioned, was an insider, and she was tortured and abused. And John Brennan should have been fired because he violated the separation of powers when he shut down the Senate's investigation by withdrawing materials from the Senate computers. He sanctioned the break-in of the Senate computers, and they were studying torture and abuse and issued this authoritative study, 6,000 pages, that's now sitting somewhere in a warehouse, never to be read, which is a very sad fact, but it was killed by the Obama administration. So yes, an outsider is what they need. Someone's got to go in there and clean out these Augean stables. That's what I'm hoping for.
I'm very excited. Now I have to be unhappy.
Oh, no.
Back to what happened on Wednesday. Part of what bothers me, we're talking about cleaning up the institution. There are so many institutions that need to be cleaned up. Obviously, we know about the eight members of the United States Senate, the 136 members of Congress who voted basically not to accept the electoral vote. I am actually also worried about what we're now beginning to see with what's been infiltrated in the Capitol Police, what has been possibly infiltrated in some of the military, in some of the National Guard. We are now looking at a situation where we're beginning to wonder, who do we trust? I mean, there is a situation now where I think everyone is looking not only at the 4 years of Donald Trump, but this has actually, I think, existed long before this. We've seen sort of white supremacists that have sort of put on a uniform and joined the uniform. The problem is, if those white supremacists are now going to be assigned to protecting the Capitol or protecting the president, you have to start asking the question, how do you root them out, Mel Goodman? How do you deal with that problem?
Well, one of the things that's going on now that is very worrisome, there are two countries that have this problem. of finding police, active police and former police, active military and former military in these white supremacist organizations. And that's in Germany.
Yeah.
So if we're going to find that here, and when we think about Germany and the history of Germany, this is extremely worrisome. But I think the real problem is the breakdown of government in terms of chain of command. Because when you look at the various institutions, who is really in control here? The mayor wasn't in control because she has no real power. The police chief of the Capitol Police actually has become the scapegoat. He did all the right things. He tried to get more support. He tried to get the National Guard. And he was ignored by the House Sergeant of Arms and the Senate Sergeant of Arms. And then when they tried to get the National Guard, the military, which was embarrassed by what happened on June the 1st at Lafayette Square, when they were involved in something where they should have been nowhere near the premises. And the chairman of the Joint Chiefs merely apologized for that. And the Secretary of Defense said he was wrong. And 10 former Secretaries of Defense actually wrote a very strong letter about the role of the military, that it should stay away from U.S. elections, has no political role. So there was a fear about sending the military, a fear about sending the National Guard. But what's at the root of this, and you identify it, is white supremacy. And here what bothers me is the Department of Homeland Security, when that was set up in the wake of 9/11, was designed to deal with intelligence matters in the United States because the CIA by charter can't do it, and they shouldn't. The National Security Agency by charter can't do it, but they were violating our emails and our phone calls with their massive surveillance. But Department of Homeland Security, in view of the terror attack, where there was sufficient intelligence to prevent it on 9/11, was supposed to be investigating terrorism of this type. And they determined that the real terror threat wasn't radicals from the Middle East. It wasn't Islamic fundamentalists. It was white supremacists in the United States. And they were shut down by the Trump administration because they didn't want to deal with that. Because what is it? Well, that's part of Donald Trump's base. Or exactly. It is Donald Trump's base. So they...
Exactly.
We denied ourselves the intelligence we need. And the thing I worry about now in shutting down Twitter to these people, I don't think we should be doing that. We're lucky they were on Twitter. We're lucky that they identify themselves. We're lucky that they gave up their agenda. We knew what they were about to do, but ignore the intelligence because we didn't take them literally and we didn't take them seriously. So when you look back at it, when you look at the seizure of the Michigan State House, those thugs showing up with their highfalutin weaponry, that was a dress rehearsal for what we saw on January the 6th in Washington. And it was the same mobsters, the same thugs who were involved in Michigan, who were involved in Charlottesville, which was totally racist. Mm-hmm. So what it frightens me, and this is not going to go away, is there are people in this country, and it's maybe a larger group than we realize, don't respect us for being a democracy and don't really care if we're a democracy. But they want to hold on to their whiteness. They want this whiteness. They want to bring the country back. They want to bring the country back to what it was. And to them, what it was a system where white supremacists were in control. Trump, they say these were dog whistles. These weren't dog whistles by Trump. You know, Richard Nixon used Spiro Agnew for dog whistles to the South. That's why he put Agnew on the ticket in 1968. This was an open campaign to get white supremacists and evangelicals. That's why Mike Pence was made vice president, to bring in the evangelicals. And that's the Republican base that over 143 members of the House, all Republicans, signed on to. And that's why now we have this debate. Is it going to be an impeachment? Is it going to be censure? Is it going to be the 25th Amendment? My feeling is get him out of the White House. What is the shortest road to getting him out of the White House? Because you know darn well, if Pelosi in public has to call the chairman of the Joint Chiefs to say, keep him away from the nuclear codes, we've been there before too. 1974, Nixon was facing impeachment. Henry Kissinger, the national security advisor, sends a note to James Schlesinger, the Secretary of Defense, saying, if you get any orders involving the military from the President of the United States, do not put them into effect. You call me. So Schlesinger sent an order out to the Joint Chiefs of Staff saying, if you get an order from the President of the United States, you don't put them into effect. You call me. So everyone is concerned about that. And I knew from 2 years ago, and I think I mentioned this on one of our sessions, one of our great chats, that the Marine barracks 2 years ago were concerned with the problem, since they're there for honorific reasons, but also protection of the president. What happens on the inauguration day in 2021, when he won't leave the White House? What would be the role of the Marine Guards? Well, whose role will it be? I assume he's going to get out because he's going to be out of town. He wants to avoid the embarrassment of not being there when Joe Biden is going to be inaugurated as the next president of the United States. But the job that Biden has in front of him in terms of rehabilitation, rebuilding, and dealing with this cultural divide in the United States, I wouldn't wish on anybody.
Back in October of 2020, I saw an article, Mel, at The Conversation, and it was entitled, "Americans Aren't Worried About White Nationalism in the Military Because They Don't Know It's There." You should invite her to speak at Johns Hopkins. Her name is Jennifer Spindell. She actually is at UNH, okay? She's a professor at UNH. She came on the air. She was beyond brilliant. This is her area of expertise. And by the time she got done with the 20-minute interview, I wanted to vomit, okay? Because this is what she has been following. And we've known it with the cops. How many cops were at the Capitol assault, okay? There are a lot of cops around the country because they were part of the calling of Donald Trump. You know, they made him almost an honorary cop.
How many fire department holding the best started an investigation now?
Number of people who were in the military. The woman that was killed. She had a military background. And she was trying to crawl through the broken glass. As I'm looking at that, and you said, you can't imagine what Joe Biden needs to do. How do you deal with this? It's a voluntary military. They've enlisted. They have a right to their political beliefs, even if they're, you know, wearing a uniform. But right now, because of what's happened, because of the legitimacy that Donald Trump has done, it is no longer just about the sort of their inert political beliefs. It is now taking on something, I think, a little more horrific about certain decisions they may make when it comes to, will they escort Donald Trump out or will they protect Donald Trump? Will they see Joe Biden as a legitimately elected president or will they not see Joe Biden that way? There is a Quinnipiac poll, listen to this, a Quinnipiac poll about Republican voters. It just came out today. 73% say Trump is protecting, not undermining democracy. 70% say Republicans who voted to block electors were also protecting, not undermining democracy. And 73% there was widespread voter fraud in 2020. And Donald Trump has an approval rating of 71%. Now, that's just the GOP. But I'm just telling you, even after what they saw on the 6th, look at the number of U.S. senators that voted to still basically say that this election was fraudulent. I'm just trying to figure out, how does Joe Biden dig into this and begin to rehabilitate? Because I feel like it's got roots everywhere.
It has roots. That's why accountability is so important. And the mistake that Barack Obama made when he came in 2009, he had a moral issue to deal with. The presidency is about moral leadership. Right. The moral issue was this country conducting torture and abuse. This was sadistic, in essence. It was a sadistic policy carried out by sadists. And when Obama said, we're not going to look in our rearview mirror, we're going to look ahead, I realized there was going to be no accountability. When he kept Robert Gates on at the Department of Defense, I realized there is going to be no accountability. So what Joe Biden is going to have to do is refer to the fact that we need accountability, we need knowledge, we need transparency, and we need openness. So we have to do what societies have done that have found corruption in their midst, whether it's East Europe in the communist era. They held truth and reconciliation investigations. South Africa did this after apartheid. And we're going to have to do something like this, not to just learn about what happened on January the 6th at the Capitol grounds, but what are the roots of this situation? And why is this country so culturally divided? But those who break the law, who engage in violence, have to be punished.
I have two questions for you. One is, what was your reaction to Joe Biden's announcement of Merrick Garland as his attorney general? And the one thing that gave me such incredible pause, I mean, all I remember about Merrick Garland was that they thought he would be acceptable to the Republicans, which is why Barack Obama nominated him. So I don't see him as a controversial figure. I see him, if he's acceptable to the Republicans, I'm thinking, what does that mean when he understands his job? Joe Biden keeps saying he will be independent. I will have no influence over him. That's fine. That's a good statement out of Joe Biden. But I am trying to figure out, what will Merrick Garland understand about dealing with this incredible corruption? I don't want him to use his prosecutorial discretion and ignore the past. I want him to go after this corruption because I want the message out there. It can't be repeated. That's number one. And number two, what about the problem with us not really having the understanding of domestic terrorism? That is the other thing, that we don't really have an ability to sort of respond to domestic terrorism the way we have the ability to respond to international terrorism. And that right now is becoming a huge problem, and we saw it on the 6th.
Okay, those are two very different issues. I don't have the qualms you have about Merrick Garland.
Okay, good.
He is conservative in nature. He's a moderate, and that's why the Republicans like him. He sanctioned what eventually became the Citizens United decision when he was appeals court judge. And that bothers me a little, but that's not what's important about Merrick Garland. What's important about Merrick Garland, and it's the same thing that's true about Bill Burns, he is a judicious public servant, a man of great character, a man of great integrity, who will rebuild the Justice Department. And that's what we need to do. Rebuild the Justice Department, find a way of eliciting the return of those people who left the Justice Department. Unfortunately, a lot of people didn't leave the CIA. I think it's important sometimes to protest that way. The CIA didn't do it for this reason or that reason. But justice, a lot of good lawyers left. They will come back under Merrick Garland because of the respect this man has. So I'm not worried about Merrick Garland. And when you look at the Justice Department, it wasn't just Garland. Look at the team, Lisa Monaco as his deputy. The thing I like about Biden, it's been a team approach. He's identified an issue. What needs to be corrected? If it's immigration, you get experts on immigration, which he did for Department of Homeland Security. Right. If it's the economy and inequality, you get people like Janet Yellen and build an economic team. He's built a justice team. He's built an environment team. Right. So don't worry about that. On the issue of domestic terrorism, I've been saying this to you for the last several years. The Democrats have been trying to fool themselves and convincing themselves as they got into denial that Hillary Clinton lost the election because of Russian interference. That had nothing to do with why she lost the election. She lost the election for a lot of reasons. I wouldn't put Russia in the top 10 of those reasons. So instead of looking at the enemy within, we found it's very easy to bang on the Russians. We're doing it now with China, by the way. We're building up the same kind of Cold War rivalry that's going to hurt this country in the long run. China is a very transactional kind of country that's into economic security. That's all they want to deal with. You can probably conciliate all these other issues as long as they find a way to build their economic power, which is a legitimate way. It's a mercantile system, and that's what they practice. And that's what involves them in the third world. But don't make them the enemy of the United States or even the adversary of the United States. They're a competitor. Mm-hmm. So as soon as we recognize that and then recognize the role that terrorism is, Walt Kelly's Pogo said it best. We've met the enemy and he is us. Read the wonderful Wilkerson book, Caste, that talks about, are we going to be a democracy or are we going to be a society of whiteness? And that's what we're dealing with, this small group of people. And frankly, I don't think they're that large. I don't think they're not that well organized. On January the 6th, this was not a coup d'etat. This was a frenzied mob that probably had more leadership at the top than we realize. But if you go into social media, as some good correspondents have done, it's all there. All the clues are there. All the information is there. All the evidence is there. But we chose to ignore it. And some of that was for political reasons.
A professor from Princeton referred to what happened on January 6th as a lynch mob. That's how he looked at the events that happened. We're familiar with lynches. We've had 4,000 lynch mobs over the course of the last, you know, since the 1950s. It's not a surprising thing, but you're not worried about them. A small group of people, well-armed. What could have happened on January 6th is Vice President Pence could have been hung. Nancy Pelosi could have been killed. But for the grace of God that they were not able to get them and that they were able to hide, in a lot of ways, meant that only 5 people died, 3 from whatever causes and 1 with suicide and whatever. If it had been 2 minutes either way, Mel, something else could have happened. And I know it's a small group, but they're well armed. And whether they use Parler or Newsmax or whatever their new platform is going to be, they also know through social media how to connect together and to operationalize the things they do. You're looking at them as small, and I'm looking at their lethability.
No, obviously, we know they're lethal. We know how much damage they can create in a very short period of time. And we were very lucky on January the 6th that we were dealing with just such a motley group of imbeciles and miscreants and who knows what else. But it also exposed the inefficiency of our government, the disorganization of our government, the inability to these organizations to communicate with one another. The inability of the Capitol Police to convince the House and Senate Sergeant of Arms of what needs to be done. The Army so worried about their image and how it would look. This wasn't a question of image. When I looked at the situation, and I have no background of law enforcement, why weren't there fire trucks with hoses, which is very good in crowd control? Why weren't there policemen on horseback? You put policemen on horseback in crowds, and I've seen that when I was a demonstrator in the Vietnam War, the 60s and early 70s. That's very intimidating to come up against something like that. Nothing like that was discussed.
I know.
Even in hindsight, when we look back, no one was talking about that. We have lost a lot of political skills and political ways of doing business because the last 4 years have been so corrosive under this maniac. We have to come to terms with the fact that when he said American carnage 4 years ago, it wasn't a description, it was a prediction. And here we are now living with American carnage.
I talked to a friend who is a card-carrying member of the ACLU. Their fear about this new move to really begin to address domestic terrorism, the idea that they're going to be able to sort of monitor behavior, it in part is that sort of ACLU sort of stance that says, wait a minute, what happened to that level of privacy? What are we doing now under the guy? I mean, in a way, what Donald Trump has done is in part sort of almost a continuation of what we saw and our reaction to 9/11. What 9/11 was successful at was that if you are Black or you are Muslim or you are a foreigner, then guess what? You are by definition someone that should be perceived as a threat. What now has happened because of Trump and because of what he has really incited is that now we find out it's everywhere.
Everywhere.
How do we deal with that racism and still recognize that there has to be some kind of a line drawn between how far the government can go to investigate? Do you want the Capitol to look like Fort Knox? Well, right now, yes, I do. I do want barriers up. But what does that say about what has become of America? That we're now are afraid of ourselves.
I went down to Lafayette Square mainly to see the fencing. It's such a terrible sight to see.
Yes.
I remember the riots of 1968. At least they put up wire that was almost invisible. You didn't know there was essentially fencing around the White House in 1968, but there was. And they brought in all the city buses, the metro buses, to surround the CIA so you couldn't use any of those streets. It's sad to think that we've reached that point. We are a country of institutionalized racism. And until we deal with that, until we admit to that and agree that it needs to be addressed, but Biden has made this a huge part of his agenda.
He has no choice because, look what happened in Georgia. I mean,
there's going to be Republican opposition to that because that's a racist party, unfortunately. Yeah. It's a party of white supremacy. So until we get leadership within that other political party, as long as we're just a two-party system, it's going to be very difficult. You know, thank God for Georgia. And that's such a great story, a Jew and a Black
Reverend.
Pastor. I mean, it's just an amazing story that was lost on January the 6th because it was overtaken by this horrific news cycle.
It's an amazing story because when you actually look at them, we haven't even talked about the numbers that they were able to beat their Republican opposition. There were 4 and 5 times more people voting for Ossoff and voting for Warnock than ever voted for Joe Biden when you actually look at the final results. Mel Goodman, thank you so much. Apologize for waking you up at 7:30 in the morning.
Oh, no, thank you for my wake-up call.
Oh, no, it was the best thing. William Burns, congratulations. All right, everyone, stick around. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will be right back.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazarus, and this is Climate Connections. In sub-Saharan Africa, over 500 million people live without electricity. For lighting, many of them use kerosene, a fossil fuel that contributes to global warming, emits toxic fumes, and can start dangerous fires.
So we started looking for a low-cost way to provide electricity for an entire village.
That's Jeff Schnur, CEO of Jazza Energy. The company figured out a way to meet that goal without conventional power plants and a distribution grid. In Tanzania, Jazza Energy has built about 75 solar hubs, small buildings with solar panels on top. Two women from the community staff each hub. The women use the solar power to charge battery packs. Customers rent the packs and use them to power lights, charge cell phones, and for other small electricity needs. Schnur says it's cheaper to rent a battery pack than it is to buy kerosene. So the approach not only helps protect the climate, It can save people money and improve their quality of life.
The hub operators that we call Jazzastars, the women running the locations, are literally lighting up house by house in their community. When you sit down and hear directly from someone how it's just a dream come true, it's pretty transformational.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Welcome back to part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. As soon as I saw the Capitol policeman that was killed was from New Jersey, I immediately knew that he would be writing about it. I immediately knew that he would know more background information and that this would be a conversation not just about June 6th, not just about a Capitol policeman that was killed, but that we would look at the events leading up to June 6th and the events that have sort of followed June 6th. And he would have a lot to offer. And I was absolutely right. Joining me right now is Robert Hennelly. Robert Hennelly writes for thesalon.com, Insider NJ, the chief leader. You can find him at Stuck Nation. And he has a whole series of articles that he wrote. The most recent one came out this morning, and it was entitled The Fog of Democracy, Chertoff Considers the Crisis. I want to welcome you to the program, Bob. And as we're getting ready to bring you on the air, we really wanted everyone to understand that you can't look at the events of January 6th and assume that it was a discrete event. What we are looking at is really a rolling event. There were things that rolled into January 6th, and it's going to continue to roll out beyond January 6th. And while we're going to see a transfer of power on January 20th, it is not going to go away. And then the question is, how do we become aware of the events that are surrounding us? How do we respond to those events? And is there anything that government leadership can do to either tap it down or to remove it like a cancer, to be honest with you? Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. I think that it's important, as we've said all along in this series of reporting since we connected with each other, this transition was going to be more like what we've assumed occurs in like Nicaragua or a place where there has not been a tradition of democratic transition, and that it's also mixed in with a pandemic. And so it's important to see that Donald Trump's assault on the civic structure is multi-layered. So we can't let him off the fact that it's to me, at the same time as him directing an insurrection at the Capitol, where he targeted, by the way, by his actions, the sitting vice president of the United States, Mike Pence, and number three in succession, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. In addition to also trying to derail the peaceful transition of power that is symbolized through the memorialization of the Electoral College vote. To this degree, it's very reminiscent historically to what happened right after we surrendered, the South surrendered Appomattox, and within a few days, Booth decided with his conspirators to assassinate Abraham Lincoln. But what's been lost in history is that this was an attempt to decapitate the leadership of the Union coming out of the cessation of hostilities. So you had Vice President Johnson was supposed to be targeted, and actually Secretary of State Seward was stabbed and bore the scars for the rest of his life. We see here, I don't think it's coincidental that a day after Georgia fell to the white supremacist South, where we elected, as you've said, a Jewish American and African American preacher, that the supremacist South rose again, and we actually saw something that didn't happen in the Civil War, to my knowledge, was a Confederate flag in the Capitol.
Yeah, incredible, incredible. And I'm so glad you connected it in a lot of ways to what we actually believed in Georgia, which was the rising of a new South, a right. South that really reflected the population, a South that really had said to the African-American population, you have power, you have numbers, exercise the franchise. This is your state. These are your results. These will be your senators. You have a right to this. And what is so amazing is not only what Stacey Abrams has done, you know, for years now, because ever since she lost her race for governor, she didn't walk away. She invested and invested and invested because she understood voter suppression. And she knew that that was going to be part of the landscape, and she needed to either get around the voter suppression, do a work around the voter suppression. And as I've talked to people over and over again, in a bizarre way, the pandemic was a gift. As awful as the pandemic was because in so many states, not just Georgia, but a lot of states, people had to accommodate people to vote. That meant that they could expand early voting. They could expand voting by mail. They could expand absentee voting. And it turned out that what got her able to overcome the suppression was COVID-19, right, on top of her work. I mean, it was an interesting synergy of the two happening together. And to some extent, Joe Biden was successful. But by the time the election took place on January 5th, she was really ready. And the pandemic had really gotten people really prepared for what they needed to do in order to vote.
Well, it also made it so that the gross inequalities, which have been increasing exponentially over my lifetime and are now getting to a crushing level, we're brought into this base belief in everybody's life. So now you have a situation where millions and millions of Americans who are kind of hanging on the edge, those are the people that, you know, we know that the Federal Reserve tells us at any given time before this pandemic, 40% of Americans would have trouble scraping up $500 for an expense. That number is much higher now. And we've seen the concentration of wealth accelerate. We've seen billionaires make more money than ever before, and their share of the wealth grow. And also, we've seen this healthcare crisis blow up. And so that states that chose not to opt into Obamacare and expand Medicaid, their populations are paying a dear price.
Texas,
all that happened
Texas,
at the same
Texas.
Time. And to your point, demographers and people that look at projections in terms of voter turnout, we're talking about this kind of, I'll describe it as a kind of minority majority, as something that would come to fruition down the line. All the most optimistic projections were talking like, oh, well, that's around the bend a bit. It's coming. But you're right. It did act as an accelerant to be here and present. Now, the problem is that there has been for a long time this undercurrent, and this is what is becoming so challenging, where we did see Donald Trump successfully exploit what had happened with the abandonment by both parties of the working class. And he has now made a pitch and dug down into the heart of so much of America that he has cleaved off. For instance, law enforcement unions have come to associate Donald Trump as their savior. Yeah. And that's a problem.
That is a huge problem.
And so what's happened is primarily because for decades now, law enforcement around this country did not perceive systemic racism and actions by police that were racist as being a corruption issue, which is what they should have. They made excuses for it. They paid tort claims, like in New York City under Michael Bloomberg, $1 billion to just resolve it and not have anybody held accountable. Now it's become so corrosive that it undermines the very republic itself, because racism, as it was executed and has been permitted, is lawlessness.
Let's remember that before Donald Trump played this card with the police unions, the governor of Wisconsin did that.
Right.
I mean, the governor of Wisconsin divided the teachers' unions from the police unions and the firefighters. Right. And so guess what? He was recalled and he was brought back in. Why? Because he was able to divide the unions. I mean, I hate to say this, but there has to be a come to Jesus moment with whatever's left in the public sector unions. There is no private sector unions.
Right.
But the public sector unions right now have to sort of look at their own base and have a conversation with their own base, because there's a real problem with the police union, a huge problem. And we saw that it played out in Wisconsin. And are we surprised by what Donald Trump was able to effectively do? Because he already saw, well, that's the strategy and it works.
Right. And also what he did was, by cleaving off, for instance, out of a big union like the American Federation of Government Employees, the Border Protection Unit, like he was making this play. And so now you have the police unions increasing on the defensive. There has to be a conversation about, we're seeing around the country, all sorts of internal investigations being prompted by this, because there are a number of former military, active duty military, and even active duty police officers that were present in some capacity that is now going to be sorted out. And another thing that is part of what's driving this, and I think it goes back to a decision that Richard Nixon took during the Vietnam War, the military industrial complex learned a very important lesson, that a military that requires conscription, that is that you are going to have to pull the sons primarily out of households at random, right, and get them to serve, means that you have to have a certain kind of buy-in from the public. And in the Vietnam War, something we lived through, you and I, people were going to opt out and did opt out. So the solution of Milton Friedman and his approach and Nixon was to create an all-voluntary military, a permanent military class. And this is also a big piece of what you saw going on here. And so we now have this kind of permanent further notice military. And in some ways, the fact that Congress was in such a diminished state, if you were to just be pretend you're an anthropologist, Congress is a victim of the fact that itself had given away so much of its power post 9/11, that it is so anemic that it was vulnerable to this kind of thing politically.
I don't know if you heard this, but the Republican Attorney General's Association was one of the sponsors of January 6th. Okay.
Yeah, robocalls, event, right?
Okay. They did robocalls. You saw that. They did robocalls. They were talking about the election steal. This is the Republican Attorney General's Association. They're 501c4. So, and I'm thinking, okay, what does that mean? And they need to be challenged. They need to be asked, because they're now aiding and abetting not only what Donald Trump basically has, the lie and the mythology of him, but they basically were supporting financially what ultimately turned out to be this incredible attack on the Capitol. People need to connect the two, and they need to be held accountable.
Well, and that's starting to happen. One of the problems in general has been that elected officials, you have your Governors Association, that's a fundraising opportunity. You have your Democratic Governors Association, another fundraising opportunity, and your Republican Governors Association, and the similar situation with attorney generals. Corporations, oddly enough, were the first ones to push that button that you described.
Yes.
When that story went out, they wanted to know, well, what happened to that $50,000 we sent you? Maybe we shouldn't have sent it. So that's to the good. I would say that the other part of this and is that we really have a hard time grasping, and this is going to be a challenge for Joe Biden. What this reveals is the entire disaster that our national defense structure is. And that's hard to take, that in the 20 years that since 9/11, we spent hundreds of billions of dollars a year on a construct that had us looking at the Arab world as the great threat.
Right.
And I had to sit through the 9/11 Commission hearings, and that was some tough medicine. And one of the big drop dead moments was when the NORAD officials had to be tested, where they were asking about NORAD, which is that Canadian American defense system. And there was this collective aha moment that our entire radar network was arrayed to be on the lookout for incoming aircraft, right, with no ability to really understand any internal threat. I submit to you that that is exactly what happened here, that we've allocated all our resources on a failed presumption. And what I pointed out in the piece is that a police officer, Sicknick, who was at the Capitol Police, had been in the Iraqi theater. He was involved. And when he came back, he got a job as a municipal janitor. getting ready to try to get in the civil service somewhere, and wrote these letters to the editor in 2004, taking to task George W. Bush for the further notice war in around the world that he didn't see making us any safer, right, and made the connection that people were dying for oil. And how unjust that was. Now, he also was, and this is hard for people to understand.
A Trump supporter. He was a Trump
supporter.
Right. Because someone is a Trump supporter, does that mean I can't trust them? Does that mean that they can't do their job? Does that mean when they're part of the Capitol Police, they're not going to protect me? Do I have to look now with a jaundiced eye and say, are you going to open the doors for these crazies? Or are you going to protect me, which is what your job is? I'm assuming he protected us. Right. I'm assuming that's why he got killed. Because he did not open the doors. He was, in fact, between them. And the fact that you even have to ask this question is so terrifying. And then you tweeted something out just this morning. You wrote at NBC News, the FBI warns local law enforcement agencies across the country of possible armed protests in all 50 state capitals starting January 16th. And an armed group has threatened to travel to D.C. the same day and stage an uprising if Congress removes Donald Trump. Okay. So we're all looking, oh, isn't this terrible what happened at the federal Capitol? And I'm looking, well, what about Concord? You know, what about Boston? We're going to start looking at all 50 states and realizing this isn't just a DC problem. They're looking at all forms of government as if they're a threat.
Right. And I would say that it's important as citizens to hold accountable law enforcement and our government to note where there's been major deviation right now from standard procedure. The fact that I've been doing this for 35 years, the fact that something would unfold like it did at the Capitol, now we're talking Wednesday, we're in Monday, that the Capitol Police have not had a public briefing to explain what happened, nor has the Department of Justice, should make us all feel this is really an ongoing coup, in that the various agencies are trying to protect themselves. And there's more emphasis on trying to get their story straight than on disclosing to the American people with transparency what went wrong.
Cover your you-know-what is a normal knee-jerk reaction, especially when you see what a disaster that occurred. There's a part of me that goes back to what happened with the Black Lives Matter march in the fall. It was an overreaction. It was a military reaction. It was so over the top, despite what was being predicted with Black Lives Matter. I think to a large extent, everybody was saying, well, we can't respond the same way. The problem is that when it was a Black group of people, this is how you respond with such incredible force and helicopters and a military presence. And now because Donald Trump invites these white people to come and be wild and basically to attack and march on the Capitol, we can't respond the same way. So here's what I'm trying to figure out. What would have been worse, to be consistent in your behavior? Wouldn't that have covered your butt better?
I would say
to be inconsistent in your behavior. And when the Black guys show up, come down like a hammer. And when the white guys show up going, oh, we were so embarrassed by the hammer, we're going to now bring about, you know, we're going to have tweezers.
And that could have very well been an excuse. I would say that you have to roll back to the way that the white supremacist threat and what happened historically has always been downplayed in America.
Yes,
and I'll give you an example. These tragic deaths that happened at the Capitol, particularly the police officer, of course, we mourn any loss of life, but it's hard to do for someone that is already trying to overthrow the government. But when you look at what happened in Charlottesville, do you know that there were two state troopers that died? Did you know that two state troopers? You see, you are one of the most informed people I know. They were in a surveillance unit in the air trying to keep an eye on what was happening.
Oh, yes, I remember the press.
But when they died, not part of the story, because subtextually, we kind of went along, the media did, with Trump's analysis that there was wrong on both sides, just false equivalency things. Scroll forward. It's very important to take apart the TikTok here. We do now have an interview from the police chief of the Capitol Police, a $500 million operation, Mr. Sun, who has resigned, but now has given the Washington Post an interview that he asked for National Guard, not once, not twice, not three times, but six times.
Wait a minute. Let me ask you a question. Did he ask for it six times on the day of the
event? No, Sunday is what his accounting is, he asked. He had seen what was happening online. He asked for this protection. Also, it's important to take, which is the positive, I think, dispositive, is what Governor Hogan, a Republican from Maryland, tells us. A whole other thing corroborates it by saying that he gets a call from Steny Hoyer, who is now under a table somewhere under the protection of Capitol Police saying, there's no cavalry. We've lost control of the Capitol and we can't get the National Guard here. Now, what's very important here and should be a piece of evidence in the trial that we should be having of Donald Trump is that for 90 minutes, this was permitted to be the status quo. And so Hogan, who's no shrinking violet, tried for 90 minutes to get the National Guard there. Meanwhile, the National Guard, Secretary of Army, finally calls and says they're going to be there. Now, the New York Times has confirmed who was the person who summoned them, because under the law, the National Guard movements have to be done by the Pentagon and normally, ding, 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 the president. But he was busy doing something else. So it was Vice President Pence who actually got the National Guard to respond. So we have, in essence, just to boil it down, the Vice President of the United States, under protection of the Secret Service, in hiding, calling for the cavalry to arrive when his superior, his direct report, the President of the United States, refused to do so. That's it. That's the story.
It's incredible. After this insanity and everyone feeling so vulnerable, you still have 8 U.S. senators and 136 members of Congress to basically say that this election should be challenged. I mean, right. You just can't believe it. This is a great quote. Someone posted this and said that the whole idea here is that the reason why they fear the insurrectionists, so they're going to basically embrace the idea that this election should be overturned because they know that if they don't do this, the insurrectionists will run against them in 2022 and will beat them. So the insurrectionists basically have them sandwiched. They have to do something they don't believe because they fear that if they don't do what they don't believe, that when they run in 2022, those people that basically have embraced the mythology will run against them and they will win.
Well,
because
actually,
they're so gerrymandered that guess what? The crazies will show up in the primary and they're toast.
Well, and that's why there's been reporting by NBC that Republican members of Congress said they were afraid for their families, that they made the decision they did to stick with their plan A, even though they knew that it put the nation in peril. And buying into this mythology now has got its own momentum. I mean, it's a serious question to me. And of course, the concern is here, we can dismiss it as a minor thing or how foolish these people were. But I think it was a propaganda windfall for these people.
It was. I go back to Vice President Pence. Vice President Pence has been the most loyal puppy dog that Donald Trump could ever have. He did everything Trump wanted. He gave him his evangelical cover. He gave him every excuse. He looked the other way. The only time he basically did not carry his water was going to be on January 6th. That was the only time. So what does Donald Trump do? He puts a target on his back and they seek to hang him.
Right.
Think about that. Just once, the only time he's basically said no to Donald. And look at Donald's revenge.
Right.
It has to be shocking. You were talking about all these members of Congress worried about their families. Donald Trump has everyone worried for their family. They're not the only ones. I hate to break it to you. They're not the only ones. Every family in America is now afraid because they see the level of instability. They see, as you just pointed out with NBC News, it's coming to a capital near them. It is not something that happens only to members of Congress. It's right. Now going to be happening to attorney generals in New Hampshire, to secretary of states in Georgia, to the governors in Texas. This is where we have to understand it's not just your family that's not safe. It's all of us.
Right. I do think, though, they're setting themselves up for it's going to be hard to match what they did in terms of public relations. And I do think that this has caused a redefining of American politics in the most profound way, maybe since the Civil War. And so there are some alignments that I do think are hopeful. So we are seeing, I mean, we had former Homeland Security Michael Chertoff, who I know from his time here in New Jersey, who was actually, prior to becoming secretary, was counsel to the New Jersey State Senate Committee that investigated racial profiling and was part of the effort to try to throw light on the state's efforts to conceal its systematic use of racial profiling in the state police. And he made the point that we have to be looking on CBS News about unconscious bias in addition to overt bias. And so you have a combination where people perceive risk. They see 7,000-8,000 people coming down the street and they think that looks like Uncle Joe, or that is Uncle Joe. And so your entire aspect, and there is footage where you see Capitol Police officers actually pulling aside the gates. I mean, I'm sure you've seen that footage. And others where,
right.
And then you see other footage where they are posing with selfies. And then we see amazing acts of heroism, the African-American Capitol Police officer that take this rabble through, this racist rabble through a magical mystery tour away from where the principals are hiding. Right. And it's all happening in real time. The tragedy is that we have built a multi-billion dollar architecture and gone into debt to do it and deprived ourselves of basic public health, leaving us open for the pandemic to protect ourselves when we've never been more at risk.
The whole thing is just so incredibly shocking. And yet at the same time, as I'm looking at the situation that Joe Biden goes into,
right.
I say this over and over again, my audience is going to make me think I'm crazy. I hope everything he does that's positive, whether it's a check, whether it's a vaccination tent, I want him to understand this is your government responding to your needs.
Right.
This is your government here to help. And the interesting thing is that right now, once again, corporate America is doing what government can't do. It's Twitter that's shutting him down. You know, it's Google that's shutting him down. It's the App Store that's shutting him down. We couldn't do it. Government couldn't do it, but they could do it. And now what we're finding out is Goldman Sachs saying we're not writing checks, you know? It's all the big corporations saying we're not going to give you money because, of course, because of Citizens United, they've been able to sort of put in billions of dollars right. into these campaigns and especially into Republican campaigns. But let's be honest, they bought both sides. Is Joe Biden going to find corporate America as aiding and abetting his ability to bring back stability, as aiding and abetting his ability to make it possible for government to be effective? Because unfortunately, what corporate America has done is make government only effective for them and not effective for us. I wish I were a little bird and I could go into the next 6 months and sort of look back and see what happens, because I think this next 6 months is actually going to predict the future of the country.
I think so.
It's going to be decided in a very short window. And then the question becomes, are we in this together and do we find a way? Thank you. I appreciate your call. All right. Take care. This is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producers Dave Scott, and of course, Stephanie Collins. And we have to thank Robert Hennelly from Salon.com, the chief leader and the insider NJ and at Stuck Nation. All right, everyone, we'll schmooze tomorrow. You Change.